When he was sure she was secure, Farron launched off the edge of the brig and caught an H-shaped girder with the ease of a gymnast catching a bar. Riding his momentum, he let go with one hand, reaching out for the next grip. His fingertips caught it, but not by much. He felt a hot sensation in his side, near his thigh wound. He pushed the feeling away and focused on going forwards. Time was running short. On and on Farron went, the engine of his enhanced physiology driving him forward. He was Adeptus Astartes, a Primaris Marine. He would not fall. He glanced at the helm's lens chrono once more as it steadily ticked down.
"Hold on,"
he said, hanging with both hands from a robust girder as he gathered his strength.
"Just get on with it,"
said Deal through gritted teeth. He felt her legs wrap around his waist and tighten. He saw muscled arms in his peripheral vision as the rig's woman reached up and grabbed the girder herself to take some of the weight off.
"It's fine," said Farron. "I have this."
"It's quite a way," she said.
"I said I have this."
He scowled and set off once more. For a minute, he made good progress, but the woman's weight seemed to be growing with each passing minute. He checked his vital signs and noted with a kind of abstract interest that he had lost a good deal of blood from the injury the human psyche had inflicted. A wound in a space marine's physiology would normally clot and scab over quickly, the hemastomon's vital elixir conserving the fluids in a matter of seconds, but this wound had not been inflicted by any normal weapon. For some reason, the blood was not coagulating. Fresh and unhurt in the arid air of Mars, Farron knew he would be able to make such a journey three times over and feel little more than a pleasing burn of exhilaration. But here, after the exertion of a battle, with a human cargo skewing his balance and with a thigh wound open and bleeding.
Slowly, insidiously, the seconds on the chrono ticked down. 5 minutes left.
Now the waves were slapping at his legs. He tucked them up as best he could and pushed onwards. Swing, catch, readjust, swing, grab, swing. Somehow, he had lost focus. He had not come this way before. The girders here were slick with algal slime, and with each handhold, he felt his fingers slipping. He had to make it to the next solid grip. With a heave of exertion, Farron lunged for the promethium pipeline. He caught it easily enough. Then a wave slammed into his legs, and he nearly lost his hold completely.
"Oh, God, Emperor," said Deal. "Please tell me you can do this."
"It's fine,"
said Farron, tensing and relaxing his muscle groups to keep them from burning with the acid of exertion.
"Is it?"
Farron did not reply. The repulsor was still a full two-thirds of the rig's width away, and they were fast running out of time.
"Where in the Omnisire's holy wilderness is he?"
said Vesley, racking the bolts into his ammo clip for the ninth time in as many minutes. Around him, the rest of the squad were seated in the passenger hold of the Harrower, each busy with his own thoughts or rituals.
"He will make it back in time," said Ghazar,
over the Voxlink. It was a credit to his rapport with the Harrower that he had brought it back to full function after the battle, for the tank had taken several plasma hits and ion discharges on its outer hull. With the electrical interference still affecting its systems, Ghazar's voice carried a strange, tinny quality.
"No doubt he wants to make a grand entrance," said Morricani. "I imagine he will burst through that door at the 11th hour to our rapturous applause."
"What if he doesn't?" said Thrun.
"A valid question,"
said Vesley, taking the bolts out of his ammo clip again.
"What if they've discovered he made an unauthorized sortie? That will not reflect well on us. We might even get reassigned altogether.
Then we shall excel, center stage in a different theatre of war," said Morricani. "Be serious for once in your life, Morricani," said Enrod. "We can't miss the muster. Farron's got us in enough trouble as it is."
"I am being serious," said Morricani. "He will be back in time."
"I hope you are right," said Enrod.
Silence enveloped the interior of the Harrower once more, the only sound the regular tick-clack, tick-clack of Vesley's bolts being racked, cleaned and re-racked in his rifle, over and over. Farron hung from the underside of the promethium rig, Deal's arms locked around his shoulders. She had brought her legs up high around his waist now and entwined her ankles and feet to keep from dropping down into the crashing waves. The lieutenant swung his legs back hard, then brought them forward and turned with the motion, extending an arm to grab at the next stanchion. He found a solid grip, then rode the movement to grab for the next. He waited for a moment, tucking his legs as a crashing wave rose up to grab at him. Without the tide, Farrant could have got into a rhythm, let the swing of his own momentum do much of the work, but with the waves against him.
"We're not going to make it, are we?" said Deal.
"We have to," grunted Farron. "Be silent. I must conserve my strength."
4 minutes. One slip is all it would take. Even if Deal managed to swim to safety once more, she would be frozen to death before long. Farron would die far sooner, plunging down into the depths like a stone. Swing, grab, scrabble, shift. The running joke amongst the Primaris brethren was that, though a space marine would sink fast, his sheer muscle density and the weight of his battle plate would bear him down. His armor and physiology were so robust, he could simply walk along the seabed to the shore. But on an ocean world, with a hole through his armor and a wound through his black carapace right into his abdomen, the pressure of the deep would claim him, just as it would any mortal man. His progenoid glands and the gene seed they contained would be irretrievably lost, leaving a hole in the annals of the chapter forevermore. Swing, grasp, breathe, reposition. 3 minutes left. They were still only halfway back, and it had taken 12 minutes to get to the brig in the first place. Farrant reached up to a spar of metal girder where a patch of seaweed had taken root, and the brine paint had flaked away. Taking their combined weight in one hand, he hammered the most rusted part of the girder with the ball of his other hand. A few more times, and a jagged wedge of metal fell away. Farron caught it deftly before it fell into the crashing waves. He examined the long triangle of metal for a moment.
"Take this," he said to Deal, holding it by the sharp end.
"Why?"
"Just take it."
She grabbed hold of it without saying a word.
"Now, drive it into my side wound. Aim for the heart."
"What?" said Deal, her voice a disbelieving screech. "Are you mad?"
"Just do it. It is our only chance."
"You're insane," she said. "You'll kill us both."
"Do it. You're wasting time. Trust me."
Deal yelled out, a cry of anger and frustration. She slammed the long, rusted shiv into Farron's wound, all the way up, sinking it into tough flesh until it was buried deep. Farron's lips curled, his eyes watering as the pain shot through him. His grip on the algae slick girder grew weaker as he felt the rusted knife grazing his ribs, cutting at his right lung and puncturing his second heart. It was enough. A huge rush of stim chemicals roared round Farron's system as the implanted organ, known as the Belisarian furnace, pumped hard into full effect. Triggered by near-fatal trauma, the furnace was designed by Archmagos Call to give the Primaris Marines one last burst of killing energy to let them claim revenge before their death in battle. Or in any extreme situation come to that. Farron felt his strength return, flow through his limbs, every blood vessel tingling and pulsing as he pulled himself up once more. With his eyes so wide he felt like they would never close again, Farron swung from girder to stanchion to pipe with jerking, desperate speed. He punched his fingers through rusted metal and crushed steel pipes as he made the straightest course between himself and the repulsor. Deal hung on for grim life, arms and legs locked and hair whipping across her face as the wind and spume tugged at them. The hungry waves reached up to grab at their legs, but Farron barely registered them. He breathed through froth that tasted of coppery blood, felt muscles sing even as his injured heart bled into his thoracic cavity. He was dying, that much was certain, but the repulsor was close, and he was getting closer with every passing second. Farron sensed something watching them, back at the brig. A sensation of disapproving eyes piercing his back niggled at the back of his mind. Then it was lost amongst the pain and a growing sense of triumph. 30 seconds later, Farron was kicking at the Harrower's door with the toe of his boot. The ingress hatch hissed open, and Vesley looked out, his handsome features a mask of confusion.
"Get her in!" shouted Farron.
Still hanging from the rig's underside, Farron shrugged Deal forward with his hip. She took the hint and climbed into Vesley's arms. His battle brother, too stunned to argue, carried her inside. The lieutenant swung in close behind, coming in so hard that he bowled Vesley backwards. Deal staggered away to rebound from Morricani's broad chest. Farron fell clattering to the floor of the repulsor, clutching at his side. His hand was covered in half-clotted gore.
Throng, Farron, said Enrod. You stink of promethium and blood.
He needs help, you fool, said Morricone, punching open the repulsor's emergency cache and carefully extracting the dormant Mediskull inside it. He muttered an activation phrase. Hellblasters were no strangers to tackling irascible machine spirits, and set the skull hovering free.
He's shaking, said Gazar over the Introvox. His furnace is activated.
He made me stab him in his wound, said Deal. It was the only way, he said. Somehow it made him fight twice as hard to get back. I could barely hang on.
Farron struggled to stay conscious as the skull machine hovered down close, its syringe-tipped manipulators reaching for the red mess that was his side. A sharp spike of pain, and his entire flank became numb. Dimly, he registered his chronometer. -3 seconds.
Your anticoagulants are working again, Farron, said Morricone. We'll get you stable. Then Varad and Ortinicus can see to you when you get to the ship. We'll tell them it was embedded shrapnel. Rest now. Gazar, get us out of here.
Farron nodded weakly in thanks and let himself slip away. Chapter 4. Shield of Untruth. The Liminal Conquest. Progress Class Star Cruiser. Slipstream enabled. Flagship of the Fourth Sphere Expansion.
High Commander Shorestrike, most profound greetings of the Tauvar, said Tutor Twiceblade.
His eyes were cast down, and his hands were held out towards his superior in the offering gesture of the gift well meant.
The surviving teams are recovered. We have experienced the losses of 2 ghost keel warsuits and 5 stealth teams in total, with another 3 reduced below operational parameters.
Your candor and precision is appreciated as ever, said Shorestrike.
The regal figure standing in the flagship's underslung viewing dome did not look round.
My thanks, loyal Sharkovash.
I mean not to contradict you, but it is twice played now, High Commander.
I offer contrition. I had only recently reconciled your last alteration. Perhaps such a long stasis demands frequent change to keep things in balance.
The High Commander still did not turn, instead staring out at the stunning view below. According to the honor guard outside, Shorestrike had not left his position for an entire rotar. He had stood, motionless, seemingly spellbound by the panoramic view of the ocean planet the Guevesar called Saltire Vex. Twiceblade could see why. Swathes of spiraling cloud over a jade and black ocean were dotted by the tiny orange pinpricks of the human rig settlements, each circled by screeds of relevant data on Shorestrike's vast command suite overlay. Tutor Twiceblade knew the commander well enough to realize he was present in body and mind, but not necessarily in spirit. The journey through the subrealm had taken a terrible toll on the commander. Ever since their re-emergence, his famous clarity of thought and deed had been compromised beyond recovery. Some amongst the Firecast's least circumspect were saying the surety for which the commander had been named, that confidence with which he had carved a new destiny for the Fourth Sphere expansion, had been shaken, shattered, and cast away.
The Aircast report that the anomaly is leaving low orbit, Commander. It has rendezvoused or docked with a larger craft and is now bound for deep space. It is still baffling our scanners somehow, but the Earthcast say they can still follow its heat trails.
Thank you, Sharkovash, said Shorestrike.
Twiceblade folded his hands over his solar plexus in the guard against offense at this second nomenclature gaffe, but the implied admonition was wasted. His superior did not see it.
That is good news, continued the High Commander. Perhaps we can reveal the anomaly's location and destroy it before it bears its taint to any other Guevesar worlds, or to any of the Guelar species come to that. They are already corrupted 100 times over.
That is true, said Tutor Twiceblade. Rogue mind science is toxic to the order from which the Tauvar is born, doubly so amongst the uninitiated.
The commander sighed, his head hanging.
We cannot destroy every Guevesar world, facility, and ship, Twiceblade. let alone every Gwaelar stronghold. Even should we make it back to the Sept Worlds, and even should we convince the Awun of the righteousness of such a cause, it is not logistically possible.
The tutor did not reply.
Our very empire would turn against us to ensure our failure, continued Surestrike. It is impossible.
What if we could show them the evidence, Commander, said Twiceblade. What if we could show them what we have seen?
They would never believe us, not if we had 1,000 recordings of the Mind Curse to prove it. To deal with this poison, we must use the tourniquet and the heated blade.
What if the curse spreads? What if we fail and the main vector of infection spreads through another populace? These barbarian Gwaelar know not the meaning of quarantine.
We will not fail, said Surestrike,
still not looking round.
We will cauterize it before it bleeds any more of its venom into the cosmos.
Should I tell the Aircast to engage if they have the chance?
No, said Surestrike. Identifying particular bodily remains in a debris field is all but impossible after the macro-level trauma of a naval engagement. For now, we follow. Maximum sensor range, plus 15%.
As you say, Commander, said Twiceblade, adjusting his stance to that of the protege at attention. The siphon structure on Saltai of X may still have infected Guevezar upon it. Some of them are undoubtedly mind-cursed. Would you have us launch another strike and eradicate it completely?
No, said Surestrike. No more overt action at this site.
With respect, we must stop them, insisted Twiceblade. The Guevezar exemplify the corruption of the Tauva. Did I misunderstand your position on the subject?
We cannot risk open attack, sighed Surestrike. If word gets back to the Sept Worlds that we are slaughtering human helpers inducted into the greater good, the Fourth Sphere Initiative is as good as lost.
As you say, said Twiceblade, doing his best to keep his tone neutral. Though perhaps, if the greatest concentration of the Mind Cursed is upon the rig the Guevezar designate Omicroid, we could engineer its destruction and leave.
There is no need. I have already assured its destruction.
High Commander.
Surestrike moved a finger and slid it over a wide circular informational. He enlarged the view of the human settlement tenfold, tap-engaging satellite drones and complex star sun filters to cut through the clouds of water vapor. Intrigued, Tutor Twiceblade approached Surestrike's personal hex display and peered down at the crude structure. From above, its girders and supports came into focus. A skeleton made from ferrous ore, according to the Earthcast analysis teams. How the humans imagined that primitive iron structures would last among such a concentration of saline solution, he did not know. Hundreds of such rigs dotted the ocean world's surface, their stout legs drilled into the planet's crust under the seabed.
It is hard to believe that a thick coating of paint is the only thing between these facilities and the entropy of the ocean they parasitize, mused Twiceblade.
They stand against storm and tide alike, said Surestrike, lifting the raised palm of the gate immovable. Proud and stubborn, yet locked in a war they cannot win. There is a strange beauty in that.
Twiceblade was about to make a neutral reply when the image of the rig suddenly exploded, blossoming into a spreading flower of orange and black flame.
Commander, said Twiceblade, was this the work of the Gwaeron Shah Space Marines?
No.
Then you brought about its fate.
I ensured it in person. My cold star is subtle enough to evade detection by Imperial craft, especially in an active war zone, and deft enough to place explosives at critical points.
But it was my understanding you never left this bridge, High Commander.
Surestrike finally turned, fixing Twiceblade with a strange stare.
I will do anything for the greater good, Tutor Twiceblade. But I will not turn the Empire against itself, nor inflame the war between the Tau Empire and humanity. To do so is to act against the Tauva in a direct fashion. That is a far greater crime than allowing an abstract threat to survive. Now, if you will kindly leave me to my thoughts.
Tutor Twiceblade averted his eyes, made the hands-clasped sign of the Chagrin student, and left the viewing bridge without looking back. High Commander Surestrike shut down the hex informationals and stared once more at the ocean vista stretching before him. One of the recessed alcoves to Surestrike's left slid open. He did not look round.
It is wise to have one who challenges your suppositions so close to you, said a smooth, feminine voice. To have one who fears for a greater conflict, yet follows orders nonetheless.
I know this, said Surestrike. That is why I give him audience.
Do you keep my counsel for the same reasons?
Your guidance is invaluable, most noble Aun Shao, in ensuring the fourth sphere does not become a footnote lost to history.
The right words, yet I feel there is nothing behind them.
There is nothing behind my eyes, either. You said so yourself, wise one. I remember it all too well. Perhaps I have more in common with our guest in the munitions deck than I like to think.
And yet, you have a place in the greater good, an important one. Aun Wa saw something in you, and Aun Wei before him. Your time is now, High Commander Surestrike.
This I know. It is why I am here, as the figurehead of this expedition, talking to you.
Then do not forget it. You have a duty to fulfill.
The speaker in the wings of the dome made the gesture of the setting sun. With a soft hiss of an iris portal opening, she left for her own quarters. Surestrike dismissed every drone attendant still hovering on standby, sending them away one by one with complex motions of his fingers. He stared unblinking at the vista shown on the command suite for a while longer. He paid particular attention to the tiny flames dancing above each of the surviving Promethium rigs that dotted the ocean world of Saltai Vex, and the larger flame that was once ferro-giant Omicron. The flickering lights reminded him of something, something that made his soul ache with loathing and loss. Then, when he was sure he was alone, he crouched down in a ball and keened in despair. Chapter 5. White Lies. Apothecarium. The Executioner's Blade. Zedro Farron opened his eyes, his hands automatically checking for his bolt rifle. It was missing, and with it, a great part of his calm. His augmented senses focused, relaying information through the fevered mist that threatened to consume his mind. A bright azure light shone down upon him, directed right into his eyes. It was dimming, then narrowing, then dimming again, before blazing so bright he could feel his irises contract. A firm hand pressed down on his neck, then on his chest, cool and certain. He felt a sharp pain in the side of his throat.
Progenoids, unharmed, said a voice.
It was so flat it was almost mechanical, with a definite rasp of augmetics.
The same cannot be said for his third lung, nor his secondary heart.
Farron struggled to speak, to sit upright, to tell them he was conscious. He found he could not move anything, not even his eyelids or his pupils. Yet he was undoubtedly conscious.
I still find this bio-architecture impressive, even for one of the Adeptus Astartes, said the voice beyond the bright light. Every sinew is reinforced with these coiled metal springs. There is this bio-amplifier behind the hearts, and some manner of hybrid gland. I confess it is still a mystery. The rhythms do not map.
Just do what is required of you, Varad.
The second voice was familiar, registering in Farron's half-comatose mind as a malignant presence on some level. But with his bodily systems locked in a silent battle and his mind struggling to remain barely conscious under a cocktail of suppressants, Farron could not quite place it. His eyesight was adjusting now. That omnipresent azure light was cast by something that floated, close enough to grab. Long, thick cables hung around a serried string of bone protrusions that reminded Farron of a dangling spinal column. As his mind slowly pieced together the meager stimulus it could find, he realized that it was just that, a servo skull adapted for the use of sanctioned Medicaid. He was among his Dark Angel's brothers then, in the apothecarium. He should have been reassured, but strangely, the tight feeling in his throat did not recede.
"We will have him at full combat efficacy within a day, perhaps two," came the sonorous voice, the buzz of sibilance making it sound as if it was coming over a voxlink rather than from mere feet away. "What of his battle plate?"
"Ortinicus is seeing to it," said the second voice. "He will ensure it is returned to him in an appropriate condition."
"Has he mastered this pattern, then, this Mark 10 model?"
"He studied for years upon Mars's soil. If any amongst our circle can understand the craftsmanship of the Martian priesthood, it is he."
"I feel, given the complexity of their biological and psychological systems, that he will find that a challenge."
"That is his lookout. Concentrate on your own duties."
"Of course."
Farron saw something, a point of darkness, grow closer. It blurred, becoming a fuzzy black spot. He felt a sensation of proximity, and then a piercing pain right in the center of his eyes, lancing to the back of his skull.
"Welcome back, brother."
Farron felt some of his old confidence return at the sound of his old friend's voice calling from the communal space designated for Primaris use. He smiled, just a little. It was always amusing to him that Morricani could tell his approach purely by the rhythm of his footsteps. Farron walked without even a trace of a limp, for his torso wound was already at operational parameters. The boots of his recently repaired Mark 10 armor thudded evenly on the vaulted chamber's alloy floor, their solid crump helping his surety return, little by little. There was Morricani, seated at a brushed steel mess table. His mad ivory smile was so wide, his incisors were plainly visible in the corners of his mouth. The Hellblaster sergeant got up and strode forward as Farron made his way into the common vestibule, clasping the lieutenant's upper arms in the Terran fashion, before making to deliver a sudden headbutt. Farron jerked back, then broke Morricani's grip with a shrug of his arms, in the same motion stabbing a pair of fingers up like a dagger to push hard under his friend's jaw.
"Omnis, sire! You're as quick as ever, then,"
said Morricani, swatting Farron's hand away.
"Just checking that psi wound hasn't robbed you of your faculties." "You do anything like that in front of the others, Sergeant Morricani, and you will receive a swift and brutal reminder of why I carry a superior rank."
"And every bit as serious," laughed Morricani.
"I remember when you valued a quick test of reaction speed. It broke up the boredom of transit." "How long have I been out?"
2 days, perhaps, not even that. We Primaris Marines heal quickly."
"Did I miss much?"
"We are making for the Scorpid Cluster, according to our brief," said Morricani.
"Which, as hard as it is to imagine, was the briefest yet. We are to rendezvous with the Angels of Absolution before making our next attack. Ultimately, we will face the green-skinned menace, I'm pleased to relate. A simple, straightforward war of extermination. Likely one that even you can wage without ending up on the slab."
"Another jab, brother," said Farron. "I must leave myself open to them."
"Usually."
"Are we not to conclude our business with these Tau, then? Any news on why we withdrew so suddenly?"
"Not so much as a binaric screed."
Farron's brow knotted. This behavior was like no other strategic protocol he had heard of, within the Adeptus Astartes ranks or without.
"Odd. How is the Harrower? Is she still in the same condition as when I left?"
"She is," said Morricani, his smile flashing wide.
"She's doing fine, inside and out, thanks to Gazar's ministrations."
"The cargo, I mean."
"Well enough, though a little shaken by the battle. Stowed away on the transport deck designated for us Primaris Marines, as though we're lesser citizens. She's down there with all the other repulsor transports, of course."
"Excellent," said Farron, smiling at Morricani's double talk. "We must make full use of the opportunities afforded to us."
"You have been missed, Zedro," said Morricani, "by all of us. I will be more than glad to accompany you to check on the Harrower."
I will not refuse your company, said Farron, his expression grave. Another painful memory came to me as I was out, or it may have been a dream. I can barely remember it.
Oh? Was it the one where you gambled through a field of tulips?
An intense light, ebbing and flowing, and pain. Lots of it.
Morricone's expression curdled, turning from his habitual wry smile to a look of severe consternation.
Brother, is something wrong?
That light, said Morricone quietly, blue in coloration.
It was, said Farron. Light azure, maybe white at times.
Morricone put a hand to his forehead and rubbed it, staring intently at the grill of the corridor.
And the pain, was it in the eyes?
It was, said Farron. And behind them?
Morricone met his gaze, and for a moment he seemed like an old man.
Enrod has been having the same recollection, he said quietly. And Lenkatz recently confided much the same. I don't know if you noticed, but yesterday Vesley intimated that he too had a pain behind the eyes.
Farron frowned.
It must be an artifact of transition sickness. I would not pay it much mind.
I'm not so sure, said Morricone. When I mentioned it to Epistolary Dothrail, he said he had felt it too, and that it was common enough. But he did not look at me when he said it, and he changed the subject immediately afterwards. Isn't that a potential sign of duplicity?
We have to trust them, Pieter, said Farron. We have no choice. They are acting in the best interests of the Legion, and so must we.
In the best interests of the chapter, you mean?
Chapter, damn it, said Farron.
Old habits die hard.
And so do you, Zedro, said Morricone. Maybe you'll even live long enough to eventually get the hang of the right nomenclature.
Thank you, Sergeant, said Farron, dryly. With the warp tides in our favour, it is only a matter of days before we reach our new hosts upon Allhallow. Perhaps you can bring some of your excellent diplomatic skills to bear upon them instead.
Perhaps I shall. We will see.
Shall we make our way to the deck, then?
Not just yet, said Farron. I must meditate. Meet me at my cell in an hour, and we shall proceed from there.
Farron tapped the release rune of his cell's alcove, and then pulled a heavy metal door until it slid closed with a dull clang. His mind was aching from the sheer volume of information he was trying to collate, to parse, to fit together. It was like trying to find a way through a dense fog at night. For some reason, the details just wouldn't fit. He sat on his Spartan slab of a bunk and let his shoulders sag, pressing the heels of his hands into his eyes. At least the wound in his side had closed over, seen to by Apothecary Varad. He took a quick look under the binding and its poultice, peering down through the headache to assess the damage. The healing process had been hyper-accelerated, so that a thick wheel of pink and white scar tissue covered the fist-sized wound in his side. When he twisted to the right, he could still feel the damage done to his lung and heart by Deal's improvised dagger. Yet, that pain too was dulled, and presumably the wound within him was also sealed over by the incredible recuperative properties of the Primaris physiology. It was a testament to Varad's skills that Farron felt able to fight mere days after such a grievous wound, and to the skills of the Tech Marine Ortinicus that his battle plate was whole once more. Each separate piece was set into the alcoves within his cell, ready for reattachment should the call to arms be sounded. He went over to the armour and lit the two sticks of preparation incense outside the alcoves, saying a placation prayer to the machine spirit before taking the plates, one by one, and holding them to the lumen brazier. He donned them carefully, feeling their interface ports click home into the sockets of the black carapace membrane under his skin. Farron frowned. Not so long ago, Tech Marine Ortinicus had claimed to be unfamiliar with Mark 10 armour. Yet, the damaged midsection plate, which upon leaving Saltire Vex had a gaping hole in the side, was now sealed over, relayered with ceramite, neuro-linked, welded impeccably, filed, buffed, repainted in deep forest green, and burnished to the same sheen as the rest of the armour. It was a feat of engineering that would impress even a tech priest. It seemed to stretch credulity a little to think that the Tech Marine had no prior knowledge of Mark 10 plate. Better yet, the machine spirit was placated. Farron had expected to have to spend hours appeasing it, if not long nights, as it was brought in harmony with his own biorhythms. But to him, it seemed wholly at peace with the repair, perhaps even docile. Recalling the anomalies he had experienced in the battle on the Promethean rig, Farron tapped through the armor's records to find the images of the Xenos foe and the weapon of the human sympathizer. The Picts were no longer there. None of his battle data was there, in fact. The Mark 10 was as good as new, just as the Tech Marine had promised him, but in the most literal sense. It was as empty of data and logged combat experience as when he had first put it on. That in itself was highly irregular. A Space Marine grew with his armor, learned to trust it just as it learned to trust him in turn, like a knight of the Elder Times becoming one with the leather insets and padding of his mail, until he and the armor moved as one. The armor, too, learned of its incumbent as the two fought together, its systems meshing ever more efficiently with the biology of the wearer until the two were all but inseparable. Yet here, his Mark 10 plate seemed almost too polished, too clean to do its job at optimum performance. Farron released the clamps at his jawline, took off his helm and rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands. What in the Omnisire's name was going on? Farron reached under his cell's bed slab, pulling out the thick half-shelf beneath it and taking an auto-quill and synth vellum scroll from the recesses there. Pushing at the heel of his hand, he slid off his powered gauntlet with a hiss of escaping pressure valves. He depressed the heat rune on his small well of sealant wax, paused for a moment, and began to write, the only sound the scratching of the auto-quill's nib as Farron's neat script unfurled across the page. There was a loud knock on the jamb of his cell's archway. Morricani's voice came through the door.
Is your hairpiece in place, Lieutenant? May I come in?
One moment, my foolish friend,
called Farron, taking a blob of sealant from the wax well and pressing it onto the furled scroll of parchment. He pressed his index finger's print into the wax by way of an official seal. Then Farron stowed the scroll at his waist, opened the cell door by way of answer, and stared hard at his friend's wild grin.
You're early, Pieter.
You present a commendably intense appearance, brother, said Morricani.
I'm not in the mood for sparring, said Farron. My armor's recent data is missing.
It is, said Morricani, his smile disappearing.
Was it lost in the repairs?
I suppose so, said Farron.
But given that it was the right midsection that was being repaired, I failed to see why the helm would be compromised.
Let's talk about it when we get to the Harrower, said Morricani. It's so much balmier down there.
Farron shook his head and moved off, the Hellblaster sergeant striding to walk at his side.
One day, Pieter, that sense of humour is going to get you killed. It is not a fit way for a Space Marine to behave.
We were taken before our prime, said Morricani, made to fight one another, put under the knife for nearly a decade, and mentally reconditioned to become living weapons.
And that is amusing to you?
It is not amusing at all. Admittedly, there is a certain irony to the fact we were made to save the Imperium, but even a glance at the skies betrays the fact we awoke far too late. We have not been welcomed as brothers, nor even as much-needed reinforcements, but tolerated as inconvenient reminders of an era long in the past. We now exist only to kill or be killed, and my particular breed of murderer specializes in the use of a gun that can snuff out its wielder just as quickly as its target.
Farron was too taken aback to say anything.
Some of our kind embrace anger and bitterness, becoming addicted to war. I look for solace elsewhere, and attempt to bring some levity to this bleak existence of death, destruction, and endless grinding repetition. Tell me again, brother, what is wrong with that?
Nothing, said Farron. My apologies, Pieter. Nothing at all.
The air of the repulsor dock was so thick with sacrament fumes and scorched oil that Farron found his eyes stinging. He replaced his helm, thankful for his rebreather. Morricani was quick to do the same.
The dockers aren't mean with their reconsecrations, are they? Said the sergeant.
The machine spirits need the respect they're due, said Farron. We'll be back in the fray before long.
Stretching ahead of them was a low-ceilinged hangar. It had 10 alcove docks stretching away, 5 on each side. 3 of the nearest berths were occupied by the slab-sided forms of repulsor transport tanks, their grav units decoupled, so they sat, heavy as bunkers, in the gloom. The 2 alcoves at the far end were occupied with single-person craft that were presumably from a previous mission, a duo Aquila pattern Thunderbolt and a drab-grey Arvus lighter. Beyond those nimble craft was an airlock bay optimized for fast deployment. Its winking lights illuminated black and yellow chevrons that stretched out to form a safety perimeter. Worker servitors idled nearby, turning their pallid heads and powering up their loading claws as Farron and Morricani entered. Farron made the sign of the cog as their bionic eyes read his new aspheric aura. They recognized him as an ally of their tech priest masters, and as one, they entered a standby trance.
"We're here for the Night Harrower," said Farron. "My name is Primaris Lieutenant Zedro Farron."
He pointed to the closest servitor, a steel-jawed corpse of a thing with a hose for a right arm.
"You, get that Arvus fuel to maximum."
The acceptance lumen on the servitor's temple flashed green. It thumped over to a stack of engine fuel cells. The others went back to dormancy, awaiting instructions.
"Let's board around the side," said Farron, quietly. "It's possible other eyes are looking through the optics of these servitors, and I'm in no mood to answer any more awkward questions."
Morricani held his palm up to the Harrower's ingress plate, and the side door of the tank slid open, revealing the white, hard-edged metal interior within. Slumped in the far corner was Deal, her eyes sunken and her straggly curled hair hanging down.
"From one prison to another," she said.
"At least this one isn't swilling with cold water,"
said Farron, climbing through the side hatch. She nodded gloomily by way of answer as Morricani joined them, pressing the panel that sent the door hissing closed.
"So, have you finally come to kill me? Tie up that last loose end?"
"Not as such," said Morricani. "Quite the opposite, in fact." "I have something for you," said Farron.
He held out the parchment scroll he had prepared in his cell.
"What is this? Please tell me it's a pardon for treason."
"Close," said Farron. "It is my personal vindicatum. It bears clear instructions for whichever Imperial servant you present it to. When you reach the astropathic nexus at Karunon, hand it over to whoever passes for a Chamberlain Master. The word of a lieutenant of the First Legion should be enough to see it expedited."
Morricani stifled a cough at the term, but Farron ignored his rebuke and carried on nevertheless.
"We will set you on your way in just a moment. You must carry word of those stranded upon Saltai Vex to the relay. Restore the evacuation protocols before the cold cycle kills you all."
Deal's eyes were wide, white, and staring in the gloom.
"You think I can make it there?"
"Can you fly a light multi-atmospheric?"
"Well, yes," she said,
blinking slowly, as if she were talking to an idiot.
"We don't have many roads on Saltai Vex."
"Void capable?"
"I've made a few trips off-world in my time. But how am I supposed to steal a ship? And what am I going to do when I get to Karu? Start a new life whilst my friends freeze to death?"
Morricani opened the far side door of the Harrower, revealing the Arvus lighter at the back of the hangar, before pressing the door closed once more. A haze of incense smoke wafted in, causing Deal to wave her hand in front of her face.
"That little fellow should get you to Karunon within the month," said Morricani. "We're most of the way to that waypoint already, and we've not yet reached the Mandeville point, so we're still in real space. Farron thought it would be good to send you on your way when we were a little nearer to Karu than Saltai Vex."
Deal nodded.
"That would be better than good.
You think this scroll will do it?"
"Almost certainly," said Farron. "The word of a Primaris Space Marine carries with it a strong association with Lord Gilliman."
Morricani made an odd noise, somewhere between a laugh and a snort.
"Zedra likes to think he is closer to the Primarchs than most."
"We are forged from their lifeblood," said Farron, solemnly. "That carries weight."
"Well, that's twice you've carried me then," said Deal. "I will not forget it. If I can put in motion a large-scale evacuation, I'll make sure everyone knows it was your chapter that made it happen. I'll make sure people know it was the Tau that attacked us, and the Dark Angels that came to defend. that the Emperor is beneficent after all. Over time, I think I can make a difference.
That would be welcome, said Farron,
feeling some forgotten emotion stir in his heart.
It is good to hear that.
Enough of this, said Morricone. Set her loose for cog's sake before I vomit in my respirator.
Every once in a while, Sergeant Morricone is right, sighed Farron. You should go. You're on your own from this point. I will cover the airlock protocols and ensure the system recognizes you as an authorized departure. It's up to you to get to Karunon and raise whatever help you can.
Deal nodded. You have fuel and food.
Your autocrat's chariot is being refueled as we speak, said Morricone, sketching a mock bow. But our particular brand of sustenance would do you more harm than good. There should be a decent survival pack in the lighter's cockpit, should there not?
Probably, nodded Deal, standing up and stretching out her limbs one by one. Good. Let's go. I'm ready. Farron noticed her hands trembling, but did not mention it. Instead, he got to his feet, nodding at his battle brother. Morricone hit the far side door's release again, and Farron stepped through, staying in front of Deal to stare down the loader servitor that came to stand in their path. Morricone shielded the rigs woman from the second servitor with his bulk, grinning insincerely at the cyborg's recorder lens as he passed. When she was clear of the slow-moving servitors, Deal ran ahead and tapped a sequence into the exterior data slate of the snub-nosed Arvus lighter. She bunched her fists as the code achieved nothing. Farron loomed over from behind her and pressed his palm against it. The craft's rudimentary machine spirit recognized an Adeptus Astartes heat signature, and its pilot door hinged open with a hiss. Deal flashed a smile up at Farron from under his arm and clambered inside, linking her thumbs in the sign of the Imperial Eagle as she climbed into the cockpit and powered it up. He crossed his forearms over his chest in the double salute of the Primaris Marines.
"You're sure about this, Zedro?" said Morricone as the lighter's hatch thumped closed. "Sure it's worth the risk. To save a planet full of humans, even misguided ones, and bring them back into the Emperor's light? Yes, I think it is. Especially if it comes out amongst the system's rebels that she turned Guevezar, as she put it, only to find that she belonged in the Imperium after all. The word of one like her will carry far.
I hope you're right, sighed Morricone. But not too far, or we will pay dearly for it. It's one thing to work beneath the notice of our masters, but quite another to shatter their unwritten rules into pieces.
Chapter 6. The Living Weapon. The Liminal Conquest. Progress Class Star Cruiser, Slipstream Enabled. Flagship of the Fourth Sphere Expansion. Tutor Twiceblade felt his pulse quicken at the prospect of disobedience, as he always did, but forced his unease back down. The hex lift was coming to a smooth halt, the status display icon winking two levels from the bottom of its range.
I don't needed, said the Hexlift's drone intelligence. Please supply.
Twiceblade pinched his finger and thumb over the sensor plate, rubbed them together, and blew softly. The plate turned from the slate grey of uncertainty to a healthy gold, as fresh skin cells and breath droplets hit its bioscanner.
Greetings of the Tau Va to you, Tutor Twiceblade, said the drone intelligence. Shall we proceed?
He hesitated for a moment, weighing his options for the 100th time.
Yes, please proceed, faithful helper.
The hex lift continued on its way, and a few moments later, the status display icon slid to the lowest setting.
Munition storage, said the drone,
as the lift doors slid open.
May you find that which you seek, tutor. My thanks, said Twiceblade, absently, venturing out.
He realized his hand was hovering close to his pulse pistol and forced himself to walk as if he had no more on his mind than retiring to his communal quarters after a long day of training. The Liminal Conquest munitions contingency deck was dark, cool, and sterile. It was the domain of the Earthcast, a subculture including many who would gladly forsake sunlight, news of current affairs, and the company of the other castes if it made their operational parameters more predictable. All for the greater good, of course, for it was their technology that underpinned the expansion of the entire Tau race. Only the highest-ranking Firecast had clearance to venture into their domain at will.
Even then, it was usually by invitation, to inspect some prototype weapon or survey some ballistics results, as the Earthcast proudly displayed their next triumph of destruction. Tutor Twiceblade made his way around the side of observation decks, through the alleys of ammunition warehouses and along gantries overlooking work areas. All the while, he took care to stick to the shadows. When an Earthcast work team thumped its way towards him on their heavy feet, he was quick to find an alcove, stack or hoverbeer to hide behind. His natural hunter's instincts made it easy enough to stay one step ahead of the myopic scientists that called this area their home. The Earthcast were excellent at focusing on matters which they were deliberately investigating, but they were famously poor at spotting anything outside their sphere of expertise. It was something Twiceblade had counted on many times as he went about his private work, whilst the Conquest ploughed through space from one zone to the next. Twiceblade ventured deeper into the bowels of the great ship, pacing along long corridors lined with lozenge lights. He fought to keep his demeanour casual, just in case he was observed or recorded by a micro-drone. No one challenged him. At one point, when the corridors narrowed, he had to shake off the memories of the passageways underneath Gelbryn City, where he had waged his one-man crusade against the Gwaeron Shah, known as the Scar Lords. They were still as fresh as if he had experienced those events yesterday, despite the fact whole centuries of chronostasis had slid past. It was not the first time Tutor Twiceblade had been down to the Earthcast hangars since his recovery from his entrapment in the Imperial stasis field, but it was definitely the strangest. This time, the weapon he had come to inspect was very different. No Tau with rank less than O even knew of its existence, and even then, the Aun had impressed upon them that the measure was only to be used in the direst of circumstances. Thahasiro, it was called, on those rare occasions the Firecast whispered of it. A term that meant living weapon. But it had another name, too. Kais. Making his way to Contingency Zone 8, Tutor Twiceblade saw his destination. A tall cylinder that tapered towards the top in the manner of a primitive racer's bullet. He stepped closer, with great care, his breath coming shallow and uneven, and looked into the elongated oval that formed its viewing window. The figure inside was relatively slight of build, his skin dark blue and wrinkled over a sparse, muscular frame. His features were pleasing enough, yet somehow nondescript, to the point of blandness. Not much for the holographers of the Watercast to use there, thought Twiceblade. His features were hollow and gaunt, a stark contrast to the noble countenances of his fellow students of Puretide. After the Arwen's great experiment with Commander Farsight had failed, Shadow Sun's warrior visage had been spread far and wide across the Empire's informationals in his place. She had excelled in the role of exemplar of the Tau Va, but after his successful prosecution of the Phi Rios campaign, Kais had been allowed to return to his cryostasis cylinder, rather than elevated to the status of a figurehead. With the Watercast deleting all footage of his victories at the Ethereal Cast's request, he had soon after faded back into myth. Only those who had looked Kais in the eye knew the truth of his quiet power. This was a warrior who had seen the face of madness and survived, who had consumed the darkness in his soul and made of it a potent weapon. To Twiceblade's mind, the commander in front of him was more lethal than any other Tau in existence. Even in dormancy, his tensed posture held the hair-trigger violence of a Phi Taon flintlock primed to fire. Twiceblade had seen that violence erupt in person. It was a sight he would never forget. The rest of the expedition believed Kais to be dormant, held in between life and death as a hero who could be revived and unleashed on a particularly intractable foe if there was no other option. But Tutor Twiceblade knew better. The first time he came to gaze upon the stone-cold features of the Monat Supreme, that warrior he had once thought of as his idol, he had seen a muscular twitch under the eye. That minuscule movement had hit him like a battering ram to the chest. The only conclusion was that cryostasis was not fully operative. Whether that was by accident or design, Twiceblade did not know.
"Awaken, Monat Kais. Please, it is Shah Korvash."
The figure's eyelids flicked open, his mismatched irises of purple and black dilating as his pupils adjusted to the light. Twiceblade felt his stomach lurch, No matter how many times the awakening ritual took place, it still felt like a claw of ice clenching in his innards.
"Come closer," whispered the figure in the stasis tube. "I will not raise my voice to you, tutor." "Of course," said Twiceblade, his heart thundering in his chest.
Long ago, hundreds of Kai Rota ago, he had been Caius's first official teacher. He had personally tutored Caius when the commander was a cadet of no more than 4 years old. He had shouted at the young warrior to reprimand him for slinking away, chastening him in front of his fellow students on his very first cycle of training. Caius's eyes had hardened that day. Even now, there was something in the way the killer looked at him that said he had never forgiven him, never forgotten. Tutor Twiceblade took a few tentative steps forward. He still felt his bones ache with the need to run whenever he stepped into the Monad's presence. It never went away, that feeling. Shortly after Commander Farsight had given him the name Shah Korvash, Fire's Worthy Cause, and allowed him to make penance for his misdeeds at Sharkanthas, the tutor had launched a one-man attack on a Space Marine command echelon as atonement. Even that was not as daunting as approaching the living weapon. As a result of that strike, Twiceblade had spent 300 Tau Seer locked in an experimental chronostasis field as a living monument to the greater good, apparently used as a motivational exhibit outside his own battle dome. He was a hero of the Fourth Sphere expansion, lauded by his peers. None of that mattered now. All that was a lifetime away, an age, a soul's journey made long in the past.
"The Gwe Veza curse is spreading," said the tutor quietly. "Of course," came the reply. Kaisa's voice was emotionless, devoid of inflection or tone. His speech had no gestural component at all. To Twiceblade, it was as unsettling as if he was screeching from a mouth with no tongue or teeth to form the words.
"It must be stopped."
"Then stop it."
"I cannot. My commander believes that circumspection is the correct path."
"Half measures are the refuge of fools."
"He has not your clarity or vision, yet I cannot convince him alone."
"Alone, a warrior cannot truly finish a battle, but he can start a war."
"Master Puretide speaks through you, as ever."
"He still has relevance," said Caius.
Inside the stasis pod, he made neither inflection nor gesture, but Twiceblade could still hear the steel in Caius's voice.
"If the vector of the mind curse could be isolated and destroyed, we could at least limit its spread," said the tutor, making the circular motion of the guardian's perimeter. "Then the work of cutting away the infected tissue from the body could begin."
"Then release me. I am the sharpest of instruments."
"I believe it. But once the vector is slain, how can we prevent the same curse from rising again from those it has infected?"
"The earth cast will answer that," whispered Caius. "Atmospheric poison, chemical sterilization, planetary core disruption, all of these are viable."
"That cannot be borne. The Guevesa share their worlds with too many Tau, and the losses would outweigh the gains. As a commander, you should appreciate that better than anyone."
"I am no commander."
"You used to be. You have to be. That is why Aonva, the supreme ethereal..."
At this, Tutor Twiceblade stressed his words.
"Placed you as a critical part of the Fourth Sphere expansion."
"I am a weapon," said Caius, something fierce in his voice. "I should be wielded as one."
"Would you not prefer to be the hand that wields the blade?"
"No,"
said Caius, the word cutting as sharp as an executioner's sword.
"We must transcend the notion of Monad as a lone warrior," said Twiceblade. We must make of that archetype a leader, an exemplar, a legend. I believe it was always Master Pure-Tide's intention that you bring its philosophy to its natural conclusion.
Caius stared at him with an intensity that Twiceblade felt might bore through the glass. The tutor swallowed and continued nonetheless.
You must act as the leader of a lone force in the galaxy, acting in the name of the greater good, unseen and unheard. Yet you must do so with not one life, but hundreds of thousands. This, the Tauva, demands of you.
Do not tell me what I must and must not do, tutor. I have planned your death more times than I can count.
Commander, said Twiceblade, his blood going cold,
I have only ever sought to aid you. I have been fully conscious for 300 Tau Seer,
said Caius, his hissing tones fierce and clipped.
An error in the cryonic process. My body was asleep, inviolate, but not my mind. Tutor Shakandas.
The tutor was stunned into silence. To be trapped, motionless and locked in a prison of immobile flesh and bone for so long, it was a chilling prospect.
My mind was not allowed to age, to fall apart as all things do. I do not understand what manner of biostasis preserved it from entropy, yet left it active, able to parse what information I was fed and lay plans as to how best to use it. But I do know that the ordeal transformed me. At times I was permitted to roam, living waking dreams in which I commanded thousands of Tau teams and led them to victory. At others I fell further and further into the darkness.
Twiceblade swallowed, his throat dry.
Do you know how many decks that amounts to? 300 Tau Seer. In that time, I have planned the death of my enemies 1,000 times over, in 1,000 different ways. It was the only thing that kept me sane.
Keeping his peace as to his true thoughts, Twiceblade looked down.
I built a war machine of causality, image by image, sliver by sliver,
hissed Caius.
I have mentally rehearsed every permutation of every conflict against every known foe of the Tau race. Every strike, every maneuver, every possible angle or nuance, I have analyzed and memorized and perfected. In all those things, only one constant. I am alone. I am Monad.
Caius stared, his eyes open a fraction too wide.
And in many of those visions, I have seen you die over and over again.
Twiceblade felt cold sweat on his wrists. The creature before him was no longer Tau, that much was obvious. But perhaps some trace of the greater good was left inside him. He took a deep breath and spoke.
You know the mind plague must be contained, quarantined, and burned clean, he said. The Guevesar curse will spread if we do not limit it. This is why I stand before you, here, now. Sure Strike's hesitancy will doom us all. You are the only one who can stop this. Tell me what I must do. Teach me. Let me be your exemplar, your protege.
Unseal this device, and I will begin the work I was born to do. You know I cannot.
Caius flew at the viewing lozenge, face distorted into an animal snarl as he hammered at it with his fists. He slammed them into the plexiglass so hard they spread smears of blood across the inside. Twiceblade staggered back, his hand flying to his pulse pistol. Then, just as suddenly, Kais stopped.
"I offer contrition,"
he said, his voice perfectly calm.
"It is the stasis burn."
I see, said the tutor. "I shall consult with my contacts in the Earthcast as to how to alleviate it."
Kais nodded, his face a mask of composure as he somberly wiped away the blood on the inside of the viewing window. Twiceblade watched as the Monat cleansed every last spot of the blood, meticulous as a spider, without breaking his gaze for an instant. The tutor re-engaged the cylinder systems, backed away a few steps, and bowed his head, with his hands forming the closing book gesture of the supplicant whose questions